The most isolated, uncontacted, unplugged people on Earth live on a small island in the Andaman archipelago in the Bay of Bengal.
Their language and their culture are still almost completely unknown.
In just a bit, Adam Goodhart tells us how he found that the people of North Sentinel Island ward off anyone who tries to visit.
They do have some very rude gestures that they like to make to outsiders.
Tap into the gazellic spirit of Amsterdam by navigating its famous canals. We'll hear how to spend a day by the water like the Dutch do.
There's nothing more fun than taking a beer or a glass of wine and putting your feet over the side of the canal and just sit there and watch the boats passing by.
And get a taste of old world Portugal in Coimbra. It's home to one of Europe's oldest universities.
A campus that is coming from a palace, from a royal palace from the 1500s.
Come along, it's Travel with Rick Steves. From a distance, you see a tropical paradise isolated from the rest of the world. But up close, North Sentinel Island in the middle of the Bay of Bengal is home to one of the most elusive tribes on Earth. Coming up on today's Travel with Rick Steves, Adam Goodhart tells us what a visit to the Andaman Islands showed him about the isolated Sentinelese people. And a guide from Portugal tells us why the venerable university town of Coimbra is such a delight to explore. Let's start the hour getting acquainted with Amsterdam's charming canals. Amsterdam, with 60 miles of canals, is known as the Venice of the North. Amsterdam's canals can teach us about its history and its culture, and they're just simply delightful. Dutch tour guide Dennis Hedits loves to help travelers understand Amsterdam through its famous waterways. He's lived in Amsterdam now for about 25 years, and he's guided for much of that time. He's joining us today to talk about how Amsterdam's canals have been tools for trade, travel, and celebration. Dennis, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, you wrote that the canals are like tools for trade and travel and celebration. How so?
Well, starting with trade, it means that the Dutch used these canals, and they still do, to transport goods over the water. Already hundreds of years ago, they have found out that it's easiest to move things on the water, much easier than on the road. Travel is because we also move people on the water. And celebrating life, this is because there's nothing more fun than taking a beer or a glass of wine and putting your feet over the side of the canal and just sit there and watch the boats passing by. And then I'm not even talking about sitting on a little boat yourself, which is actually, one of the most fun things to do.
Some of my favorite memories, you can rent a boat and, it's a little electric powered and just putt around the town, and it's just, you're in a parallel world. I've got one photo of a bunch of Dutch people in one of these party boats, and they look like businessmen who just cut out of work early and they gather together like they do it every Wednesday or something. And it's my symbol of Dutch people just knowing the balance of how much work you should do and how much living you should do. And the Dutch people love to incorporate the canals into their lifestyle, especially on a festival. I've been there on the Queen's birthday or the King's birthday, whoever's on the throne, and you can literally walk across the canal from boat to boat, can't you?
Yeah, it's amazing to be on a boat during that day. Also because King's Day, because we have a king at the moment, it sort of means no rules.
I didn't know that. King's Day is a day to break the rules.
Yes.
It's kind of a smart festival to keep people, give them a safety valve, and then they'll toe the line on the other days.
Yeah, it is actually like that. And Amsterdam is already a city with a lot of freedom and a rebellious spirit. But especially during King's Day, it's sort of going to the max. It's also the only day I don't do tours because I want to. This is Amsterdam on its best, so I want to enjoy it.
Ah, good going. I like that. Hey, just a little bit of practical background on the canals in Amsterdam. First of all, when you look at the name of a canal, you can understand a little bit about why it is there. Gracht, you see the word gracht a lot.
Yes. Yeah, gracht actually means canal.
Uh-huh.
So the Dutch translation for the word canal is gracht.
Okay. And there's four main, it seems like the historic core of the city has four canals. You got Single Canal, you got Herengracht, Kaisergracht, and Prinsengracht. Heren is the aristocrats. Kaiser would be the king, and the prince would be the prince, right?
Yeah, there's many more canals in Amsterdam, but these are the most famous ones. These were all built in the 1700s, first big city expansion of my city. And they're also all part of UNESCO, another main reason for people to visit. But in my neighborhood, there are also canals. The block I live in is 100 years old, which we consider not that old. But still, there are canals in my neighborhood too.
So the tourist just enjoys strolling down the canal, as imagine the locals do too. But there's a lot of water management behind the scenes.
Yes.
They need to be flushed out and they have to maintain the level. They need to be dredged. How do they keep the canals clean and how do they monitor the water and what kind of dredging do they need to do?
Well, dredging is something that is an ongoing thing. They are doing this every day on certain spots and it just sort of keeps on going. The canals are not that deep. In average, I would say 3 meters, which is about 10 feet. And the water level actually never goes up and down. Since we have the Delta works, meaning we sort of closed off the outside of my country, we don't have too many problems with flooding or the water. The water goes up a few centimeters when there's a lot of heavy rain, but that's it.
Okay. And when they dredge the canal, what do they find? What do they pull up? What's the junk on the bottom of the canal generally?
Trash, a lot of bikes. I think that's mostly it. These days, the canals are so, the water is so clean that we actually swim in it.
Huh.
Yeah, a lot of times when I tell people, they look at me like, like we are crazy. But this is how clean the water is these days. Of course, hundreds of years ago, it wasn't like that because then they were considered a sewer. So they would throw basically anything in it. But these days, not only our houses, but also all our houseboats are connected to a sewer. This water is so clean that in summertime, when the temperature goes up a lot, we all love to swim in the canals.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with tour guide Dennis Hedditz. And Dennis is joining us from Amsterdam right now for a look at the canals that the city is built upon. Dennis's website is lovemycitytours.com. Dennis, I understand there's like 3,000 houseboats, that a lot of these are retired, former industrial kind of barges that have been retooled. They get rid of their big engine and they have a living room and they tie it up to the canal and it's just like extra residential space.
Yeah, and it became a way of living. Already 25 or 30 years ago, the city of Amsterdam said no more new spots for houseboats, and the prices went up even more. The most expensive houseboat I have seen for sale online was 2.5 million euros, which is quite a lot.
That's $2.5 million. That's quite a nice houseboat, but can you imagine a better address? That's pretty nice. You talked about dredging, Dennis, and I understand a few people drowned every year in the canals, and usually when they pull a body up of somebody who's drowned, it's a man with his zipper down.
Yes, meaning probably drunk in the evening when it's dark, fell into very cold water.
Actually, he was going to urinate, right? I mean, he couldn't find one of the outdoor urinals, and he's a little tipsy, and that's the last mistake he'll make.
Yes. I actually read that the Amsterdam Fire Department, every year they have about 200 calls to take people out of the water. Of course, more people will fall into the water, but most people get out themselves. But from those 200 calls, only one or two people a year don't survive.
Oh, okay. And that would probably be after dark and drunk.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you're going to be drinking in Amsterdam. Don't take a pee in the canal. Just don't do that.
No.
Dennis, the big takeaway for me last year when I was with you exploring Amsterdam, you were helping me update my guidebook, the walls were collapsing and they have these temporary walls built. And these walls are like centuries old now and they were built to support, you know, smaller buildings and horses, not trucks. And there's a big expensive problem Amsterdam is facing in replacing these embankments, these canal walls. Is that right?
Yes, and maybe even one of the biggest problems at the moment. They should have started this already a long time ago, but they didn't. Mm. And yeah, from sort of say one bridge to another bridge, it sometimes takes almost half a year to redo both sides of the canal.
Yeah,
because the water they have to take the water away. They also have to watch out that nothing happens to these buildings, which are 400 or 500 years old. It's also quite sad because where they are redoing the sides of the canals, they have to take all the trees away. So imagine this beautiful canal with big green trees. And then suddenly all the trees are gone. And then it's like, you know, construction work. But it has to be done to guarantee our safety.
Well, it's a fascinating thing from a traveler's point of view to see the false walls that are built with like corrugated metal fencing, it seems like, pounded into the bed, holding back the water so that you can make the walls dry and exposed and do that work, right?
Yeah, and they have actually boats built to do it. I recently saw a movie on YouTube where they explained how they are now going to do it, and it's quite fascinating to see. And because it's so much work to redo it.
It's fascinating to get this backstory on that. Hey, Dennis, just to finish off our little conversation on the canals, there's a need for canals, whether it's in the city or in the countryside. I'll never forget going to the newest piece of land in the Netherlands, where half of the land is reclaimed from the sea, Flevoland. And it was, I understand, the last major reclamation project, essentially a new province in the country. And in that place, many of the people who live there are older than the land itself. It's all that flat, colder land reclaimed from the sea. Can you just tell us in a little nutshell why there are canals when you're thinking of reclaiming land that's below sea level from the sea? What is the function of all these canals that you find when you drive through the countryside?
Well, because as you just said yourself, a big part of my country is below sea level, they still have to drain the water out of these areas. And of course, the water has to go somewhere. So they pump the water into these canals. And then through the canals, the water can reach the ocean. Imagine a lake. They pump out all the water out of that lake, and then they create new land in that lake. But actually, the water has to go somewhere, and they still have to keep on doing that. And that's one of the reasons these canals are there.
And these canals then could be, the water in those canals could be pumped with an Archimedes screw and a windmill over the dike into the open sea.
Yeah, well, we used to do that where we back in the days needed 50 to 100 of these windmills. And now sometimes we have one big electric pump. But just in time, we realized that these windmills are part of our heritage. So the windmills that are left, they are all national monuments now. Some you can even visit inside, and then you can actually see very clear how this is done.
Dennis, it's so interesting to be with you again. Thank you for joining us, and thank you for giving us a little better understanding of something that is so integral to our visit of the Netherlands and Amsterdam, the canals. Dank u wel.
Alsjeblieft. You're welcome.
Dennis Herrits leads walking, cycling, and even private canal boat tours around Amsterdam at lovemycitytours.com. One of Europe's oldest university towns is Coimbra. We'll hear how its traditions make it a real plus for any itinerary to Portugal in just a bit. But first, Adam Goodhart tells us what he found about one of the most elusive tribes on Earth who lives sheltered from the outside world on North Sentinel Island in the Indian Ocean. You're listening to Travel with Rick Steves.
Hello, my name is Fabian, and I would like to read to you a German nursery rhyme that's been around since around 1900, and it's meant to teach children contradictions. Pretty much every line in this poem contradicts itself, and that is kind of the fun of it. In German, it sounds like this. Dunkel war's, der Mond schien helle, Schnee bedeckt die grüne Flur, als ein Wagen blitzesschnelle langsam die Ecke fuhr. In English, that means, dark it was, the moon shone bright, on snow-covered fields of green, when a coach came fast as light, slowly round the corner's beam. Dunkel war's, der Mond schien helle, Schnee bedeckt die grüne Flur, als ein Wagen blitzesschnelle langsam die Ecke fuhr.
Nestled in the Bay of Bengal in the Indian Ocean, the island of North Sentinel is inhabited by one of the last hunter-gatherer tribes who abstain from connecting with the modern world. You don't think about this island because of its untouched white sandy beaches or pristine vegetation. Rather, it's an island of mystery, known around the world for stories of cannibals on its shores. A huge buzz was generated around the island in 2018 after missionary John Allen Chow ventured to North Sentinel. Instead of bringing the message of God to the Sentinelese people, it's where he met his demise. But before his sensational story, attempts at connecting with the Sentinelese had been made on several occasions. And one man who was able to explore those waters and actually view the Sentinelese people up close is Adam Goodhart. He's written The Last Island, Discovery, Defiance, and the Most Elusive Tribe on Earth to tell us about his journeys to this fascinating land. And Adam joins us now. Adam, thanks for being with us.
Rick, it's great to be here.
Wow, what a story. The Last Island. Oh, my goodness. I want to get into that. But first, I want to talk about these elusive tribes in general. It's so evocative to me that there are tribes of human beings living as if, I think, in the Stone Age, right? Untouched by modern civilization. Can you describe the state of these hunter-gatherer tribes around the planet? And what is their technology? Is it actually Stone Age?
So you're right. It's difficult to believe that at this late date in human history, in the new millennium, there are still probably about 10,000 people in the world who are living in hunter-gatherer tribes, totally or almost totally out of touch with what we would think of as modern civilization. They're in places mostly in the Amazon, deep in the Amazon rainforest, perhaps others in the highlands of New Guinea. It's hard to say since, of course, we aren't in regular touch with them and they don't have their own Twitter accounts. But these are tribes that are living certainly in hunter-gatherer lifestyles, not using what we think of as modern technology. The Sentinelese hunt and fish with spears and arrows. But I would caution against saying that they live in the Stone Age or talking about them as though they're inhabiting another time, because, of course, they're just as much global citizens of our own day as we are. They are making use of their own technologies that are, in their own ways, very sophisticated. Imagine, for instance, being a Sentinelese fisherman and wading into the surf off the beach of North Sentinel Island and trying to shoot a moving fish with your arrows. It takes incredible technical prowess to be able to do that. So there's nothing primitive about these tribes at all.
My challenge is to get into their mindset, their global view, as I'm sure you've wondered about. And if they wanted to be connected, they could send an emissary out and they could get all sorts of help, I would imagine. But maybe they don't want help. What is their viewpoint? Because they've made a decision to be off the grid.
In fact, today, instead of calling these groups uncontacted tribes, which is the traditional term for them, anthropologists prefer to talk about groups in voluntary isolation, because clearly they've decided that their foreign policy is they don't want to be in touch with the rest of the world.
Yeah.
It could be that at some point they decide that they want to change that foreign policy, but for the time being, at least, they've made it very clear, and they've made it clear by coming out with their bows and arrows and spears when people try to get too close that they really do not.
Like, this is serious. You are not welcome here. This is not an open house culturally.
Exactly.
I remember when I was traveling in Bali, my mission was to visit with these people called the Bali Aga, and they were a remote community that was essentially walled off from the rest of the world. And I ventured up there on the back of a motorcycle with this guy. And they had made a point to be apart. In fact, they did it in part by having a very, very strict policy of if you didn't marry within the tribe, you would be ostracized. You couldn't live in that village. But it also kept them apart from the modern world, as was what their intention was.
And of course, within these groups, we know that there is a lot of diversity of opinion, as there is in every human community. And in fact, North Sentinel Island is part of the Andaman Islands in the Indian Ocean, part of a larger archipelago. And there are other tribes on some of the other islands that have a bit more contact with the rest of the world. In fact, there's a group called the Jarawa on Great Andaman Island that's very similar culturally and physically to the Sentinelese. And when I went to the Andamans for the first time in 1998, I actually witnessed some of the Jarawa, who previously had been just as hostile to outsiders as the Sentinelese, emerging from the forest and sort of extending the hand of friendship for the first time to the very different people who lived in the surrounding communities, people who had immigrated there from India, people who were living lives that we would think of as more modern and similar to our own. And it was fascinating seeing the interchanges, the interactions between these people. And there was one young man in particular whom I got to know named Enme, who was a teenager and had been one of the first Jarawa to emerge from the jungle. And when I met him, he had developed a liking for TV and candy, and he was wearing a baseball cap and sort of hanging around with the local Indian policeman. And it seemed to me that he was well on his way to sort of joining modernity.
The world. Yeah.
Yeah. So when I went back to the Andaman Islands in 2020, of course, I wanted to find out what had happened to this young man, and I expected to find him sort of living a more modern existence. But in fact, I discovered that shortly after I left in 98, he decided to go back into the jungle. He married a young woman who lived deep in the forest, and he had abandoned his modern clothing and was living as a naked hunter-gatherer again and had no interest in the outside world. He had seen enough to decide that he had seen enough.
I love that. What an interesting story. And I would think a tribe like that on the fringe of that world, there would be this notion that, hey, we could be a tourist attraction. We could get filthy rich. We could all have TVs and baseball hats. But there's a young man that tried it, and he decided, no, there's something more pristine about our lifestyle.
Exactly.
Do anthropologists look at these special, fragile, tender little groups of communities, human communities, as something that is endangered and of value and best to just kind of look at from a distance and don't disturb? They must value it in a way an average traveler doesn't.
I think they do, although I think there's also debate even within the anthropological community about how to interact and whether to interact with these groups. Of course, it's, I think, easy to say, well, we should simply leave them alone if they've obviously demonstrated that they want to be left alone. They've clearly communicated, even if we don't speak each other's language. Arrows and spears speak louder than words.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, they don't know much necessarily about all of the threats that are facing them from the outside world. And if there were to be some sort of illicit contact with this group that might introduce alien microbes that might spread disease, they don't know that there could be the possibility that they could be protected against that from modern medicine. So some anthropologists have actually argued that it's our responsibility to try to establish enough contact at least to let them know that we're here to help them in the event of an emergency. That hasn't happened yet, but it's a very, very difficult decision to make.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're joined by Adam Goodhart, and he's one of the few people on this planet to see the elusive Sentinelese people up close. He's with us now to discuss his time researching and exploring the people of North Sentinel Island. And he writes about it in his book, The Last Island, Discovery, Defiance, and the Most Elusive Tribe on Earth. Adam is a professor at Washington College in Chestertown, Maryland, and he's the director of the STAR Center for the Study of the American Experience. Adam, okay, let's get into the focus of your book. Your book, The Last Island, refers to an island that's part of the Andaman Islands. And I remember when I was a kid looking at the map, and there off of the coast of India in the Indian Ocean was this remote island, and I was just always fascinated by it. But reading through your book, I didn't ever dream of the story. That one island, North Sentinel, has a tribe that really has had a fascinating story, or history of its contact with what we would call civilization. Describe this tribe.
You know, when you talk about the Andaman Islands, even the name has a sort of a romantic ring to it, doesn't it? It almost sounds like the beating of distant drums. And if you think of the islands and what they look like, they also look like a sort of a romantic dream of a tropical, gorgeous tropical paradise. They're islands that are piled with thick green jungle and ringed with pure white sand and lagoons and coral reefs.
Yeah, you know, I was looking just through the photographs in your book. You really see that. It's like this idyllic, utopian, tropical island. And you can just imagine tribes having a potentially a wonderful life right there without any incursions from the rest of the world.
And North Sentinel Island specifically, which is one of hundreds of islands in the archipelago, really burst into the news about 5 years ago when a young American traveler kayaked onto the beach of North Sentinel and was killed by natives wielding bows and arrows. And this young man's name was John Allen Chow, and he was going as an evangelical Christian missionary. He was a graduate of Oral Roberts University, and he'd come to convert the natives to Christianity. He had referred to them as the inhabitants of Satan's last stronghold. And he did not succeed in proselytizing among them. He had a brief missionary career on the island that included his reading aloud to them in English from a waterproof Bible that he had brought with him. And what exactly he hoped to accomplish from that, I'm not sure. But in any case, he did not win their souls, but he did win another kind of immortality for himself in a sort of very 21st century way. His story and the existence of this island went viral. And suddenly, all over the world, millions of people were fascinated with the fact that here was a group of indigenous human beings who still exist in our own time on an island where they live in almost total isolation. Their language and their culture are still almost completely unknown to anthropologists, and they defend themselves with their weaponry against any would-be invader of their land. And this really just kindled the imagination of people around the world and surprised people around the world. It didn't surprise me, actually, because I had been fascinated with this island for about 20 years, ever since I was a young writer and traveler in my 20s and first heard about this place. I just wanted to know everything I could about it. I wanted to see it with my own eyes if I could. And I just wanted to be able to explore and reflect on the idea that still in this very, very explored world of ours today, there's still terra incognita.
Wow. What a story. I mean, to learn more about this ill-fated missionary's visit, well, he received a very rude awakening that they didn't want what he was teaching. You have a connection with the same people from before, but didn't end up with the same fate. Tell us your contact with the Sentinelese people.
So I went in 1998 to the Andaman Islands, and first of all, in researching what became the book that I've just published, which has been a process of many years, I spoke with everyone who I could find who had had any contact, no matter how glancing, whether people who were involved in a shipwreck off the beach of the island in 1981, or some anthropologists who went in the 1990s and they were Indian anthropologists, they managed to get far enough, close enough to the island to wade into the surf off the beach and hand gifts of bananas and coconuts to the native people.
Yeah, but didn't they? You wrote how they actually mooned him. I can just see these people mooning him and then defecating in his presence just to say, we don't want anything to do with you.
Yeah, it doesn't take a whole lot for them to moon because they're not wearing anything in the first
just
place.
Just turn around and bend over.
Exactly. They wear these little bark ornaments around their necks and sometimes a little belt around their waist, and that's about it. But yeah, they do have some very rude gestures that they like to make to outsiders, and that's their way of telling them you'd really better leave. And, you know, some of the Indian anthropologists who have spent time studying these people say that it's really worth noting that they only kill intruders as a last resort. That young American guy actually had to land 3 times before they finally killed him. On the first visit, they just sort of made these rude gestures and yelled at him. Yeah. On his second visit, a child actually came up and shot an arrow that pierced the waterproof Bible that he was preaching from. And it was only on the third visit that they actually shot directly to kill him.
Wow.
So when I went there in the 90s, I was really, first of all, just learning everything I could about the island without actually going there. But then at the very end of my trip, I did decide to go to the island. And it was a risky venture because this is a place where it's completely illegal to go. The Andaman Islands are officially part of the Republic of India, an offshore territory of the Republic of India. And so the Indian Navy and the Indian Coast Guard patrol with boats and helicopters to make sure that nobody comes within miles of the shore of North Sentinel Island. Now, of course, it's not impossible to elude them.
But the Indian government is actually physically protecting the island because they care about this fragile and precious little remnant of some age gone by.
Exactly, which is pretty amazing that in a nation of a billion and a half people, the largest nation in the world, that they would care for just a few dozen members of the tribe. But in any case, we had to think about, of course, the Indian patrols that might be circling the island. Mm-hmm. We also had to think about the fact that it was the end of the monsoon season, and so there was the risk of extreme weather blowing in at any moment. But I managed to befriend some local fishermen from one of the other islands. These are descendants of settlers from the Indian mainland, and I got them to take me in their fishing boat, which was really barely more than a dugout canoe, maybe 20 feet long, with an 8-horsepower inboard engine inside. And in this, we set out in the small hours of the night. We crossed 30 miles of open ocean until just at sunrise, we saw the light rising around this pristine tropical island. And as we drew closer, the fishermen were the first to spot what looked to me at first like a tree stump, until the tree stump actually stood up and walked across the beach. And we realized that it was one of the indigenous people from North Sentinel Island, and that I was seeing the Sentinelese with my own eyes. We came close enough to see that they were holding what looked like bows and arrows or spears. One of them actually put out into the lagoon in a small dugout canoe. And so for a few brief minutes, we were sort of looking at each other across the reef, two young men in small boats. And then, sure enough, as we rounded the far side of the island, a big monsoon storm came blowing in with an enormous water spout drifting across the ocean. And I won't give the whole story away because I tell it in my book, but it turned into quite an adventure before we got back safe.
We have more with Adam Goodhart in just a minute as he tells us what we do know about the most isolated people on Earth, the Sentinelese, who live on North Sentinel Island in the Bay of Bengal, and why it's probably best we leave them alone. And for something completely different, we'll also look into visiting Coimbra, Portugal. It's home to a distinguished university founded more than 700 years ago. We're embracing the variety the world has to offer. It's Travel with Rick Steves. Adam Goodhart is one of the few outsiders to make eye contact with the hunter-gatherer Sentinelese people. He's with us on Travel with Rick Steves to explain the issues that come up when protecting the privacy of uncontacted islanders from the influences and diseases of the outside world. Adam wrote The Last Island to tell their story. He's also featured in a National Geographic documentary about the island called The Mission. Adam also directs the Star Center for the Study of the American Experience at Washington College in Chesterton, Maryland. They examine the complexity of American history and what it can teach us today. I got to tell you, Adam, I'm just so caught up in this. It's fascinating. And looking at your book, there's collections of historic photographs that illustrate the glancing connections that different curious, caring anthropologists, travelers, adventure seekers, whatever, have found with the Sentinelese people. And you look at a photo of them being taught how to shake hands or something like that. I mean, there's stuff that we think is just fundamental. Human beings, you know, they wave hello or they would shake hands. And these people would be totally apart from that, wouldn't they?
Yeah, so the Andaman Islands are a very isolated place, not just geographically, but also culturally and also genetically. The native people of the Andamans look very different from other South Asians. They mm-hmm. are extremely dark-skinned. They're some of the darkest-skinned people in the world. They're quite small. They're almost the size of African pygmies. And they're thought to have been separate from the rest of humanity for as much as 70,000 years, based on the few genetic studies that have been able to be done.
And they've developed their own sort of wardrobe and their fashion styles. I mean, they look like they wear similar, not clothing, but bark belts and necklaces and so on.
Yeah, they've developed a whole range of very distinctive cultures. And of course, what we know about them isn't so much based on the Sentinelese, who remain almost totally out of touch, but on some of the other tribes that have mm-hmm. had contact with the outside world. And that process really largely began in the mid-1800s when the British settled much of the Andaman Islands and started turning it into a penal colony.
Do they have industry? Because you have photographs of them laying on a woven mat. Somebody had to weave that mat. I mean, we have the surname Weaver. Well, that was somebody who used to weave. And they have bow and arrows. And we have the surname Fletcher, somebody who used to put the feathers on an arrow. And they have what functions as jewelry. Do different people specialize and make something, or does everybody make everything for themselves?
These are very skillful craftspeople, and they don't really have industry, but some of the artifacts that they create are absolutely beautiful. While I was there on my first visit, I actually met someone who had found a Sentinelese bow floating in the waters off North Sentinel Island when he was there assisting with a shipwreck that had happened. And he had brought this bow back and he handed it to me, and it was just this gorgeous thing, just a beautifully shaped piece of wood with countless incised lines all over it, making elaborate patterns and painted with a sort of a red ochre paint. And so clearly these are people with a strong visual culture and a lot of skill in how they interact with the world.
And they must have some kind of religion, and a totally apart religion from any of the other religions on this planet. There was also a photo of a girl wearing her sister's skull, and there must have been a story about that.
Yes, that's something that is done among many of the Andamanese tribes. When a loved one dies, they'll set their body out to decay, and then they'll gather up the bones and actually wear the skull or sometimes a jawbone or a leg bone around their neck. And you can imagine that this has been somewhat disconcerting for visitors to the islands who were unprepared to see this. And it fed some of the early rumors that these people were cannibals, which is completely untrue. They've never been cannibals. They've never been headhunters. In fact, the only records that I found of cannibalism and headhunting were perpetrated by the European settlers themselves under various circumstances, which is a complicated part of the history. But yeah, their religions are very different. And as far as we can tell, none of the native tribes of the Andaman Islands practice any kind of religious worship. They believe that the world is inhabited by both natural and supernatural beings. They don't make a strong distinction between what's natural and what's supernatural in the world, but they just believe that they kind of exist in this realm, and there aren't the kinds of attempts to pray or to propitiate divinities that we're used to from most other human cultures. There's also, as far as we can tell, no real sort of organized government, no hierarchy among them. They live in small tribal groups, and they make their decisions by consensus. So in some ways, it's a kind of a paradise, depending on whom you ask, I suppose, but it sounds pretty good to me.
And they've been blessed with apparently no natural resources that would want to cause anybody else to invade them. You know, they talk about the curse of oil. You know, if they had something valuable there, they wouldn't exist today, but they've been untouched. Nobody has bothered to take them over.
Well, part of it is that nobody has bothered to take them over, and part of it is that they have done a very good job defending themselves. And I think we have to give them credit. And I think we also have to understand, and I discovered this through doing research in archives all over the world, that they have had glancing contacts here and there with other groups that have been enough to leave them reeling and leave them understanding that this is not something that they want and that danger can come from the water.
They're fully aware that there's a big world out there, and they like what they've got. Oh, man. You know, Adam, this is a show where it's about travel, and we sort of promote tourism, but there's no way we're going to promote tourism to North Sentinel Island.
But
of course not. Yeah, but the Andaman Islands, do they have much tourism there? And what would you just say briefly about the opportunity to travel to the Andaman Islands?
So tourism to the Andaman Islands is growing fast and really has been for the past decade or so. And as I said, these islands look like a sort of a tropical dream in a lot of ways. They're not terribly difficult to get to as long as you can get to India. And so for the time being, at least most of the tourists there are from mainland India. It's become sort of a popular honeymoon destination for people from mainland India. So it's almost a Hawaii-like place for them. But there are more and more outsiders as well, and more sort of 3- and 4-star hotels and ecotourism resorts. And the Indian government really wants to develop tourism a lot. Yeah. Although this, of course, could be problematic in that it'll put pressure on the natural resources, on the fragile environment, and on the native people.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We've been joined by Adam Goodhart. His book is The Last Island: Discovery, Defiance, and the Most Elusive Tribe on Earth. Adam, thanks again for joining us. And is there one takeaway that you'd like your readers to leave your book with? What can we learn from tribes like the Sentinelese?
So first of all, I hope that people who read my book will understand that this sort of worldwide drama, this worldwide struggle of indigenous groups against non-indigenous colonizers and explorers isn't something that ended in 1492. This is something that's going on still in different places around the world today, and there are still groups that are under threat. And not only are the individuals in those groups under threat and in peril from things like alien diseases and degradation of their environment, but their entire cultures are also under acute threat. And these are cultures that are incredibly sophisticated cultures from which we have a whole lot to learn, cultures with their own art, with their own history, with their own kinds of literature, with their own kinds of social organization, with their own knowledge of the world that surrounds mm-hmm. them. And we still, as a civilization, have to very carefully account for the existence of those people and try not to make the same mistakes that were made so many times in the past by mm-hmm. colonizers and explorers who came into places and destroyed the things that they were discovering and the people that they were discovering.
Adam Goodhart, with a last name that really mirrors your approach to this beautiful slice of humanity. Thank you very much for writing The Last Island, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Rick.
You'll find web links to our guests with the notes for each week's show at ricksteves.com/radio. For an excursion into the old world powers of Europe, don't overlook the delights of Portugal. As a maritime power, its New World colonies made it one of the wealthiest nations of the 15th century. Portugal endured a fascist regime for much of the 20th century. Today, it's an attractive and affordable destination whose traditions include great food, lively arts, and soulful music. After a few days in its capital, Lisbon, or along the beaches of the Algarve, a nice way to get in touch with Portugal's history and its today is in the prestigious university town of Coimbra. Coimbra comes with a youthful college town vibe and a walkable Arab-flavored old town, and it's just a couple hours north of Lisbon. To tell us more about what you'll find in the Oxford of Portugal, we're joined now by Lisbon-based tour guide Cristina Duarte. Cristina, thanks for being here.
Welcome. De nada.
Cristina, what makes Coimbra unique to you as a Portuguese person?
It is traditions linked with the university. The city has been developing a little bit on the shade of the university since the end of the 1200s, actually. It makes a huge impact in the city because we are talking about 23,000 students that actually have an impact in the city.
So this
right
is
now.
The university yes. town in Portugal. Yes. If you want that youthful university's kind of fun.
Yes, it's from those 23,000, about 6,000 are foreigner.
Is that right? Okay, so there's a little bit of cosmopolitan yes, action yes. there. And just the vibrancy that a university town will have. Now, I understand Lisbon was controlled by the Moors when they came in from Africa.
Yes.
And during that period, for almost 200 years, Coimbra was...
the capital of Portugal.
The capital.
Because Portugal was basically just north and center of Portugal. And Coimbra was the capital. It was the edge between the Catholics and the Moorish. So that's why our first king, second king, they were born and buried. Well, they were not buried in Coimbra, but definitely
but
they are buried
they
there.
and that's where they would have ruled from. And this
yes.
university being, you said the university was founded, what, in the 1200s?
In the end of the 1200s.
So that must be one of the oldest universities in Europe.
Oldest when they started, but the building of the university, it's not from the 1200s, but in this case it was an old royal palace from the 1500s.
Now, when I go to Coimbra, I always seem to stumble into fun traditions among the students. What are some of the student traditions we might see as tourists when we visit Coimbra?
Well, definitely the beginning of the school year, which is with initiation, and you find, you can notice easily which are the ones having the initiation, because on the first year, the students of the university, they are not allowed to wear the university uniform.
Is this a robe?
Oh, yes, it's a robe. They didn't acquire yet
okay.
the respect for having the university.
So the first year students are sort of getting
just having a hard time. Yes.
And then it's so fun when you go around town because you see windows filled with photographs of the graduating classes,
yes.
and you see people decked out.
And
in
that is the
dresses.
Second top moment of the school year, which is in May, and it lasts for 1 week. It starts with a serenade, which is absolutely breathless, is beautiful. It seems a little bit a bad convention because of the black cape of the students. And the serenade takes place at midnight in front.
What kind of a convention?
A bat.
A bat, so a bunch of bats.
They do look like bats with their black capes.
And then they all get together. And then what is breathtaking about it?
It's the environment, the atmosphere at midnight, because it must be taken at midnight in front of the cathedral, on the steps of the cathedral. And it's full of people. It's beautiful.
So as a traveler, if you're there in the spring, you're very likely to be able to see some of the festivities relating to graduation.
Yes.
And if you're going there any time of year, you can visit different buildings from the university. My favorite building was the library. Tell us about the library.
The library, it makes part of the campus. But when I'm talking about university, I'm talking about a campus that is coming from a palace, from a royal palace from the 1500s. That was added building on the 1600s, the 1700s, and the library that we are talking about, it's from the 1700s, mm-hmm. Baroque style. And inside is the most impressive collection of books, not very old books, but I'm telling you that the amount for that period where having a book was almost having like a diamond.
Yeah, a diamond. You get the sense of a book as a diamond when you go into this library, and it's so ornately decorated,
yes.
with inlaid tables with hardwood from South America and Brazilian gold leaf everywhere, and a big giant key that the attendant uses,
yes.
to open the door and let you in.
It seems like St. Peter.
It does. It seems like a precious religious place almost, and it's the library.
Cristina Duarte is our guide to one of Europe's charming second cities. We're talking about the distinguished university town and one-time capital of Portugal, Coimbra, right now on Travel with Rick Steves. Cristina's website is lisbonbeyond.pt.
And when you're in Coimbra, C-O-I-M-B-R-A, just a couple hours north of Lisbon, you also have a chance to hear a unique kind of folk music, the fado, performed by men. Tell us about fado and how it's different in Coimbra.
Mainly because the students were men. Right now is exactly the opposite. Women are more attending university than men. But on the past, it was mainly men. And so they developed this music, especially music turned to women to it's not flirting. I would like another more
elegant
word. We have that word in Portuguese, means cortejar.
Oh, it's courting.
Courting.
So these are troubadours.
Yes.
And they will court women with their
voices, with their guitars, singing these songs of the serenades. And they are very important for that. But of course that it's not only love music. Coimbra has a university city also. On the 60s became very much of a political movement,
mm-hmm.
and some of these Coimbra songs, they can be also about freedom and
okay.
can be about against the regime.
Well, you had the dictator there,
yes.
and in America we had liberal people in universities raising their voice for various social concerns.
Mm-hmm.
The same years you had liberal people in universities speaking out against the dictatorship,
exactly.
of Salazar. Today, when we go there, we can see these male fado groups in the streets and in the restaurants. You can go to a restaurant and enjoy some beautiful music.
It's not that easy. I would rather recommend to have a place where you are sure that you are going to have some fado music. Because it's students, is that probably today there is, but if they find another party, a better party to go, they will go.
Ah.
So you see, don't rely so much unless the restaurant tells you, we are going to have fados today. Otherwise, don't expect that you find groups of player performers
accidentally. So look for a restaurant that advertises.
Exactly.
Fado.
And right now, there are some groups also that provide in a regular basis,
yeah.
everyday basis.
And that's reasonably good quality for the
It's
fado.
Reasonable, very good
nice.
Quality, nice quality.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We've been talking with Cristina Duarte about the third city of Portugal, Coimbra, but in some ways it's the first city. It's the university city, and for a couple of hundred years it was the capital of Portugal. And today it's a very charming way to complement your visit to Lisbon, is to go to the smaller town, Coimbra. Cristina, if you are going to recognize that somebody is from Coimbra, how can you tell somebody's from Coimbra?
Probably because he or her will call me doctor. Instead of Mr. or Mrs., many times they call the others the Dr. Cristina, Dr. Rick.
Oh, because that's their culture.
Because
they
their
come
culture
from
is that it's a kind of a funny thing, is that as they were so many licensed people with the degrees, so many times they didn't want to risk to to not call a doctor proper name, a proper title. So,
Dr. Cristina Duarte, obrigado.
Thank you very much. Obrigada, Dr. Rick.
See you in Coimbra.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced by Tim Tatton with Casimira Hall and Donna Bardsley at Rick Steves Europe in Edmonds, Washington. Andrew Wakeling and Sherry Court upload the shows to our website. Sheila Gerzoff handles affiliate promotions. Our theme music is by Jerry Frank. Look at Rick's checklist for what to pack in your suitcase and share tips with fellow travelers. It's part of our online travel forum that you'll find at ricksteves.com. We'll see you next week with more Travel with Rick Steves.
Rick Steves' Classroom Europe is a fast, free, and fun video archive. It's designed for teachers, travelers, and students. It gives you immediate access to some 500 short video clips from the Rick Steves Europe TV show library. Clips cover European history, art, culture, food, and geography. Google Classroom Europe or visit ricksteves.com to watch clips and create your own playlist. Teachers love it. Students do, too.